crack by some. Bianca coughed. The jolt had precipitated the piece of Eucharist from her throat. In a thousand shards, the coffin shattered and Bianca sat up. She stared at the prince and she smiled. "Welcome, beloved," said Bianca. She got to her feet and shook out her hair and began to walk toward the prince on the pale horse. But she seemed to walk into a shadow, into a purple room, then into a crimson room whose emanations lanced her like knives. Next she walked into a yellow room where she heard the sound of crying which tore her ears. All her body seemed stripped away. She was a beating heart. The beats of her heart became two wings. She flew. She was a raven, then an owl. She flew into a sparkling pane. It scorched her white, snow white. She was a dove. She settled on the shoulder of the prince and hid her head under her wing. She had no longer anything black about her and nothing red. "Begin again now, Bianca," said the prince. He raised her from his shoulder. On his wrist there was a mark. It was like a star. Once a nail had been driven in there. Bianca flew away, up through the roof of the forest. She flew in at a delicate wine window. She was in the palace. She was 7 years old. The witch queen, her new mother, hung a filigree crucifix around her neck. "Mirror," said the witch queen, "whom do you see?" "I see you, mistress," replied the mirror, "and all in the land. I see Bianca."
Thank you.
That was Babushka by Kate Bush, and a little something of the next song. I just read for you a story by Tanith Lee called Red as Blood, from the collection Red as Blood, or Tales from the Sisters Grimmer. It was published by Daw back in 1986. Am I right? Am I wrong? I can't find this. 1983, in case you ever find it or want to look for it. And that was a fairly interesting treatment of the Snow White tale. And here comes an even more interesting treatment of it, I think, and more modern, that was dripping with ancient Christianity and vampires and all this ancient stuff. And here comes a refreshing version of it by the Merseyside Fairy Story Collective. And this one is called Snow White. It's from an anthology called Don't Bet on the Prince, Contemporary Feminist Fairy Tales in North America and England. And it's edited by Jack Zipes. And I mainly bought it for its title. I think it's a wonderful, but it turned out to be an absolutely wonderful anthology. And this one is, as I say, it's quite different. By the way, it is 6:40 in the morning. You're listening to WBAI in New York. My name is Sharon Griffiths, and the name of the show is Heresy. And I'll be here next week, and we'll be doing some more of these feminist fairy tales, as I'm calling them. High above a far-off kingdom, carved into the rock of a mountainside, there once stood a mighty castle. It was so high that the people working on the distant plain could look up and see it among the clouds, and when they saw it, they trembled, for it was the castle of the cruel and powerful Queen of the Mountains. The Queen of the Mountains had 10,000 soldiers at her command. She sat upon a throne of marble, dressed in robes weighed down with glittering jewels, and holding in her hand a magic mirror. This mirror could answer any question the queen asked it, and in it the queen could see what was happening anywhere in her kingdom. When she looked into the mirror and saw any of her subjects doing things which displeased her, she sent soldiers to punish them. Night and day her soldiers stood guard on the walls of the castle, and every night they watched as people from all over the kingdom toiled up the steep pathway, carrying heavy loads. Iron to shoe the royal horses, weapons to arm the royal soldiers, food to be cooked in the royal kitchens, cloth to clothe the royal servants. The procession wound on and up the mountain and to the castle. The people were carrying with them all the useful and beautiful things that had been made in the kingdom, for everything they made belonged to the queen, and they were allowed to keep only what was left over or spoiled. No one could save anything from the Queen of the Mountains, for no place was hidden from her magic mirror. Every day the riches of the kingdom were brought to her, and every night she asked the mirror, "Mirror, mirror in my hand, who is the happiest in the land?" Then a silvery voice, the mirror always replied, "Queen, all bow to your command. You are the happiest in the land." And the queen would smile. One day among the procession climbing the steep path to the castle were a pale little girl called Snow White and seven little men. Dwarves even smaller than she. Snow White and the dwarves were carrying between them a heavy chest bound with metal bands. They had traveled all the way from the diamond mines beside the distant sea. There, far underground, often in danger, they and many other men, women, and children worked long and weary hours. Every year they must send a chest full of diamonds to the Queen of the Mountains, or they would be cruelly punished. When the other people in the procession reached the castle gates, the lovely things they had been carrying were taken away from them, and they were sent away. But Snow White and the seven dwarves were surrounded by soldiers and brought to the throne room of the queen herself. "Open the chest," ordered the queen, as they bowed low before her. Two dwarfs lifted the lid. The chest was full of glittering diamonds, and on top of them lay a necklace shaped like branches of ice. The queen held the necklace up to the light. "Did you make this?" she asked Snow White. "Yes, Majesty," said the girl. "It is well made," said the queen. "You are to stay in the castle as a jewelry maker." Snow White's pale cheeks turned red, and she opened her mouth to cry no, but each of the seven dwarfs put a crooked finger to his lips, warning her to be silent. "Take her to the workshop," ordered the queen. The soldiers led Snow White and the dwarfs out of the throne room and up a twisting stairway to a small room at the top of a tower. In the room there was a workbench with jeweler's tools laid out on it. All around the walls, stored in tall glass jars, gleamed jewels of many colors, amethyst, emerald, ruby, sapphire, topaz. Little light came through the one small window, but the jewels shone so brightly that when Snow White looked at them, her eyes were dazzled and her head began to ache. Snow White and the dwarves took the diamonds from the chest and put them into empty glass jars. Then, one by one, the seven little men kissed Snow White goodbye. There were tears in their eyes, for she was their dearest friend. They shouldered the empty chest and went slowly down the twisting staircase. "You're very lucky," said one of the soldiers to Snow White. "You will no longer be poor and lead a hard life toiling underground in the mines. Here, servants will wait on you. You will sleep in a soft, scented bed and be brought whatever delicious food and drink you want. And if the queen is especially pleased with your work, she will give you rich rewards. But my friends will still be toiling in the mine," said Snow White, and her heart felt like a stone with sorrow. In the long days and weeks which followed, Snow White grew more and more skillful at making beautiful pieces of jewelry out of the precious stones and metals in the workshop. The jewelry pleased the queen of the mountains. One evening she summoned Snow White to the throne room. "This brooch pleases me," said the queen. "You may choose a reward." "Oh, Majesty," answered Snow White, falling on her knees, "please let me go home." The queen was angry. She turned her mirror toward Snow White, and in it the little girl could see the dwarves and all her other friends digging in the mine and dragging heavy loads along its narrow tunnels. "You can have anything your heart desires, and yet you ask to return to that miserable life?" the queen exclaimed. "Go back to your work and think hard before you enter my presence again." So she deftly twisted the metal and fitted the precious stones. Snow White thought long and hard. She thought of the sufferings she had shared with her friends in the distant mines, of how they and all the peoples of the land spent their whole lives working to make lovely things for the queen of the mountains, while they themselves had barely enough to live on. And Snow White knew for what she would ask. "I will make a jeweled belt so beautiful that the queen will call me before her again," she thought, and at once set to work. "Well, Snow White," said the queen as the girl stood before her throne a second time, "you have had time to think. Tell me your heart's desire and I will grant it, for what you have made is more beautiful than anything in my treasure chambers." As she spoke, the queen ran her fingers along the red and purple gems of the jeweled belt. "Majesty," said Snow White, "I have thought, and what I ask for is this. Take only what you need from the people of the kingdom and let them keep the rest, so that they will no longer be cold and hungry and miserable." The queen's eyes glittered with rage and her hand tightened on the jeweled belt, but when she spoke her voice was as sweet as honey. "Snow White, if anyone but you had spoken such treachery, I would have ordered my soldiers to throw them from the walls of the castle onto the rocks below. But you have a rare skill and are young enough to change your thoughts. Come closer and look in my mirror." Snow White looked into the magic mirror and saw herself reflected there, but strangely. She was wearing working clothes, and yet in the mirror she was dressed in a richly embroidered gown. Pearls and rubies were entwined in her long hair, and on her head was a golden crown. "You see, Snow White," said the queen, "you could be a princess. Now go." Snow White went back to the workshop. She stood gazing out of the tiny window and thinking of how she had looked in the mirror, adorned with jewels and gold. Far below her she could see the daily procession of people carrying up the mountainside all the things they had made and much give to the queen. Beyond them the green plain stretched out until it reached the distant hills. On the other side of the hills was the sea and Snow White's home. The words of a song which she and her friends used to sing when the long day's work in the mine was over came back to her mind. "Emeralds green, but grass is greener. Sapphires pale beside the sea. No jet as black as the wild night sky. No ruby red, no ruby red, no ruby red as hearts which cry to be free." "What my friends long for is my heart's desire too," thought Snow White, "but the Queen of the Mountains will never set us free." Soon the queen summoned Snow White before her throne a third time. "No flower in all my gardens is as delicately shaped as these earrings you have made," she said. "What reward do you want?" "Nothing, Majesty," said Snow White quietly. "Foolish girl," cried the queen. "I know you're unhappy, yet you only have to ask, and you can become a princess. Very well, you will continue to make jewelry for me, but from now on soldiers will stand guard at the foot of the tower where you work, and unless you choose to be a princess, you will never leave the tower again." The months passed by. Still, Snow White remained alone in the tower and did not ask for her reward. Quiet and pale, she sat at her work, thinking and waiting. When a whole year had passed, Snow White looked from her tiny window and saw below, among the people toiling up the pathway to the castle, seven little figures carrying between them a heavy chest. It was her friends, the dwarfs, at last. Snow White waited for the dwarfs to bring the chest of diamonds to the workshop, but when the chest was brought in, it was carried by some of the queen's soldiers. "The queen has given orders that you are not to see your friends from the mine," said one of the soldiers. "She is watching them in her mirror all the time they are here." "Please go to the foot of the stairs and leave me alone," said Snow White in a sad voice. "I will fill the glass jars with diamonds and put the empty chest outside the door." The soldiers did as she asked, for they liked Snow White and secretly admired her for daring to displease their queen. An hour later they returned and took the chest away down the twisting stairway and into the courtyard where the dwarves were waiting. The little men swung it onto their shoulders and carried it out of the castle gates and down to the mountainside. All that day the Queen of the Mountains sat in her throne and watched all in her mirrors as the dwarves went further and further away. By the time that evening had come, they had crossed the distant hills. The Queen smiled to herself and asked the mirror her usual question. "Mirror, mirror in my hand, who is happiest in the land?" In its silvery voice the mirror replied, "Though all bow to your command, Snow White is happiest in the land." "Snow White," hissed the Queen, "show me Snow White." Then in the mirror she saw the seven dwarfs lifting the lid off the chest, and out of the chest climbed Snow White, her face full of joy. The Queen's rage was terrible. She ordered that the soldiers who had let Snow White escape were to be thrown from the castle walls. Throughout the night she sat on her throne, speaking to no one. Then, as the sun rose, she gave orders to her soldiers. "Go to the diamond mines," she commanded. "Seal up the entrance while Snow White and her companions are working, so they will all die underground." Many of the soldiers were filled with horror, but they dared not disobey. The queen watched in her mirror as they sealed up the way out of the mine, and when it was done, she laughed. Word of the terrible thing done at the queen's command spread quickly throughout the land. Many people came to where the queen's soldiers stood guard beside the sealed-up entrance to the mine. As the day wore on, more and more people arrived. They stood there quietly at a little distance from the soldiers, as if they were waiting for something to happen. By evening, a great crowd had gathered. They lit fires to keep themselves warm through the night and talked in low voices about all the people trapped underground and about the cruelty of the Queen of the Mountains. They knew that by now there must be little air left to breathe down in the mine. Soon Snow White and her friends would be dead, as the Queen of the Mountains had commanded. Suddenly, among some rocks on the outskirts of the crowd, a tapping sound could be heard. As the people looked at each other in bewilderment, one of the rocks began to move and then was pushed aside from behind to reveal a narrow shaft going deep into the earth. Climbing from this passage was one of the dwarves. "Just in time," wheezed the dwarf. "I do not think we could have gone on digging much longer. My oldest brother remembered that when he was very young there was another way out of the mine. He led us to the place and we dug in the dark until the way was opened up." One by one, helping each other, the workers from the diamond mine climbed out into the fresh night air. Some were faint, some were bruised, and many had torn and bleeding hands, but every child, woman, and man was safe. Among them was Snow White. The great crowd of people round the fires and the soldiers stared in amazement. Then the people began to cheer. Some of the soldiers joined in the cheering, but others drew their weapons. One of these called out to Snow White. "Snow White," he ordered, "you must come back with us at once to the castle." "No," answered Snow White, "I will not go back to the castle, and we will send no more diamonds to the queen. Everyone will keep the things they make and send nothing to the Queen of the Mountains." As she spoke, the cheers grew louder and louder. "They will kill you," said the soldiers. "You may kill some of us," said Snow White, "but in the end you will lose, for there are far more people than there are soldiers." The people realized that this was true, and they surrounded the soldiers, determined to take their weapons from them, whatever the cost. Far away, on her marble throne, the Queen of the Mountains took the jewelry Snow White had made and broke it into pieces. In her magic mirror, she knew, she could see all that was happening. She knew that the people of the land were rising up against her. "Mirror, mirror in my hand, make them bow to my command," she ordered her mirror. But her mirror answered, "Queen, who was so rich and grand, the people cast you from their land." The magic mirror misted over, and when the mist had gone, the queen could see nothing reflected there but her own face. She, still grasping the mirror in her hand, the Queen of the Mountains rose from her throne and climbed the stone steps to the highest battlements of the castle. From there she could look out and see with her own eyes the crowds of people gathering on the distant plain. In fear and fury she lifted the mirror above her head and flung it from the castle walls. The mirror would not leave her hand. She fell with it and hurtled screaming down and down until she was shattered into fragments on the rocks below. And therein lies the tale. That was Snow White by the Merseyside Fairy Story Collective. And collective is a very important word in that story. Before that, you heard Red as Blood, a story by Tanith Lee. I've enjoyed very much searching through my fairy tale books, all of my little anthologies and storybooks, finding companion stories like the two I just read, which are so alike and yet so incredibly different. Now, if you appreciated these stories, you can write to me. Send me a postcard, write me a letter, do something nice like that for me. My name is Sharon Griffiths, G-R-I-F-F-I-T-H-S, and I'm at WBAI, 505 8th Avenue, New York 10018. And I love getting letters, and I love getting postcards. And I'll be back next week to read two stories that are not immediately recognizable. They are not Snow White or Sleeping Beauty or whatever, but they are about women who serve to the exclusion of their own comfort, as many of us women do. You've been listening to Heresy. That's this show. It's a feminist literary music show. Stuff that is read and played to you, for you, through a woman's perspective, that woman being me, but then again, there's something universal about it. And as I say, I will be back next week to read some more stories and to play some more music. Until then, have a good week, and I'll be talking to you. Bye-bye.
You've got your dial set to 99.5 FM WBAI in New York.
Sunday mornings are special on WBAI. Tune in at 7 a.m. for Through the Opera Glass, 2.5 hours of the most adventurous opera show on radio. Then, at 9:30, hear of a Sunday morning, early music with literate, loving commentary from Chris Wendt. So, start the week right with Through the Opera Glass from 7 to 9:30 a.m. and Chris Wendt's Hear of a Sunday Morning from 9:30 to 11:30. Some of the best music in New York on listener-sponsored WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
Good morning. You've got your dial set to 99.5 FM WBAI in New York. Through the Opera Glass is a weekly feature of this station. Today's program is pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. Our host today is Tony Koji. And now, Through the Opera Glass.
Good morning. This is Anthony Koji, and I'm your host this morning on Through the Opera Glass, a weekly feature of this station. This morning, a perennial double bill, that of Cavalleria Rusticana and Pagliacci, in a recording which is some 40 years old and which stars Richard Tucker and the Metropolitan Opera Forces under Fausto Kleber. When Cavalleria Rusticana won first prize in a contest for one-act operas, sponsored by the publishing house of Edoardo Sonzogno, it started a trend in Italian opera known as Verismo. In 1892, Cavalleria had been seen throughout Europe and in New York. This single opera made Mascagni famous and rich, but he was never able to duplicate its success, although he did write some very creditable operas. His own comment was, "It's a pity I wrote Cavalleria first, for I was crowned before I became king." The setting is a Sicilian village square, and the time is the latter part of the 19th century. After the prelude, the voice of Turiddu is heard on stage praising his one-time sweetheart Lola, who is now Alfio's wife. It is Easter morning, and villagers are entering the church. Santuzza meets Mamma Lucia and pleads with her to reveal where Turiddu is. Lucia asks why she's so inquisitive, and Santuzza is about to confess that she loves him when Alfio appears. Alfio is the husband of Lola. When from inside the church the music of the Regina Caeli is heard, the villagers resume reverent attitudes and they join in the singing. All of them then enter the church, leaving behind only Santuzza and Lucia. It is now that Santuzza tells Lucia of her love affair with Turiddu. Lucia is shocked, and she goes to the church to pray for Santuzza. Turiddu now makes his appearance, and Santuzza confronts him with his infidelity. They're involved in a bitter quarrel, as Turiddu accuses Santuzza of unwarranted jealousy. Their tirades are interrupted, however, by the arrival of Lola. She sings a happy little song, after which the two women exchange harsh words. But Lola shrugs off Santuzza's veiled accusations and threats and enters the church. Enraged by the scene, Turiddu curses Santuzza, throws her angrily to the ground, and goes into the church. At this moment, Alfio reappears, and Santuzza tells him that his wife has been unfaithful. Alfio swears to seek revenge and rushes off. We then hear the very beautiful intermezzo, and at its conclusion, after the service comes to an end, the villagers all...